What can a single company tell us about the global economy? Turns out, a lot. It can tell us a lot, actually. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Reis, and for Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, April 13th. Good to have you with us. So sometimes something micro can tell us a much larger story. And our micro case study today is JP Morgan Chase, which I know, big bank, not that micro, but just stick with me. So we've entered the thick of earnings season, and that, of course, is the quarterly parade of corporations telling shareholders how they've been doing. And as usual, one of the first to report this morning was JP Morgan with its Q1 results. The big headline is that the bank is taking a $500 million hit because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But as Marketplace's Matt Levin explains, JP Morgan's first quarter gives us some perspective to where this economy is headed.
With over $3 trillion in assets, JP Morgan Chase is the largest bank in the country, which means
JP Morgan's an enormous bellwether for the U.S. economy.
Mike Mayo is a banking sector analyst for Wells Fargo. He says the JP Morgan canary may be making some tiny squeaks in the economic coal mine. But with $8 billion in profit in the first 3 months of the year, today's earnings report was not squawking the R word.
It says the U.S. economy is strong and probably not going into a recession, at least not this year.
JP Morgan wasn't tied at the hip financially to Russia. There are no collateralized caviar-backed securities or something on the balance sheet. Where the invasion of Ukraine really hurt was where regular American consumers are also feeling the pain, commodities. Ibrahim Poonawala is an analyst with Bank of America.
They had a client who was exposed to the nickel market a month ago, and there was a lot of volatility in those markets. Similarly, oil prices.
At the same time, all the uncertainty of the past 3 months, Omicron, Ukraine, inflation, Fed rate hikes, was a money maker for a different part of the bank. When you or I freak out about the world, we binge on Ben and Jerry's. When big investors get freaked out, they pay JP Morgan to help them buy or sell bonds.
All of that has been extremely volatile, and that led to a pretty strong quarter for trading.
For its part, JP Morgan is not so freaked out about the broader economy, at least in the short term. But the bank did make a move for the medium term to protect itself against darker economic skies by adding $900 million to its credit reserves. Karen Petru is with Federal Financial Analytics.
A credit reserve is the equivalent of a rainy day savings account, and the bank just put some more money in their rainy day account.
Some of the extra money is a hedge against trouble with European loans, and some of it is a hedge against loan defaults here at home. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it is a good case of the Wednesdays. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you heard our show yesterday, which of course you did, Sabree talked about inflation at the consumer level. Today, another look at prices, this time at the wholesale level, what suppliers actually pay, also known as the Producer Price Index. In March, prices for suppliers rose 11.2% from last year. That is the largest gain on record. Just another sign that the Federal Reserve will most likely, most definitely, raise interest rates again. So today, we asked the question, how high must interest rates go to tame inflation? Sabree Benisher has that one.
There's an idea out there in monetary policy world for how to raise interest rates to beat inflation.
That's the so-called Taylor Principle.
Marcus Brunemeyer is a professor of economics at Princeton. The idea is that for every percentage point of inflation, you raise interest rates by a percentage point or more.
So if I were to have to do the Taylor Principle now, I have to increase the nominal interest rate by more than 8%.
8%. Think about how high that is, how much that would drive up mortgages, car loans, credit card bills, other loans. That would just be
way too dramatic.
Now, the reason the Fed won't go that far is because this isn't your traditional run-of-the-mill inflation with run-of-the-mill cures. Energy prices, which surged after Russia invaded Ukraine, seem to be coming back down. Supply chain problems are improving. Wage growth has stopped accelerating as people stream into the labor force, says Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist with the Luthold Group.
Since the end of October, last 5 months, the U.S. labor force now has grown at a 4.2% annualized pace. It's exploding upward.
Some analysts believe we have reached peak inflation. Core inflation, that's not counting food and energy, was lower than expected yesterday. Stephen Cicchetti is professor at Brandeis International Business School. He says inflation is going to come back down on its own, but not all the way.
Trend inflation is probably running in the range of 4% for sure. And that's likely to be pretty persistent.
Which means the Fed may have to raise interest rates to 4 or 5%.
There are no instances in the record where inflation came down without interest rates being above inflation.
Even if some parts of inflation are going away sooner, the Fed still has to do battle with rising rents and food. It also has to do battle with our expectations. When people or companies expect inflation, they just start raising prices because they expect prices to rise. And after month after month after month of high inflation numbers, our expectations have already risen.
The Michigan Inflation Expectation Survey is running around 5%. So that's a reason to be concerned. You've got to get that. You have to get that back down.
So one of the big things the Fed has to change is our minds. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
So that growth in bond investments that Matt talked about at the top of the show. Look, there are a lot of murky question marks surrounding the global economy. The war, supply chain issues, inflation. Which on that note, today, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen gave some remarks at the Atlantic Council. She talked about the war, the global economy. And she said she wants China to do more. She urged the country to put pressure on Russia to end the war, saying, quote, "The unified coalition of sanctioning countries will not be indifferent to actions that undermine the sanctions we've put in place." We told you a few weeks back that Russia is the most sanctioned country in the world. And in retaliation, Russia has banned the export of some goods to the U.S. And now that ban is showing up in some unexpected industries. From WPLN in Nashville, Paige Flager reports.
Todd Sharp is surrounded by a mountain of guitar amps. But he's quick to say some of them are better than others.
That's kind of my motto here, is that, you know, life is too short to play shitty amps.
He plugs his guitar into one of those amps.
It's flat. It's a little lifeless.
Then he plugs into a better amp.
It just makes you want to play the guitar more.
The secret sauce? That amp has these things called vacuum tubes. They're kind of hard to describe. They look like little light bulbs, and a filament glows inside.
They have this dynamic feel to them that transfers right to the tip of your fingers. Can you hear it? Yeah, but you can more feel it.
He says these tubes are the difference between a mediocre sound and a magical one. The hitch? There are only a few factories in the whole world that make these guitar amp tubes. One is in Slovakia, and another is in Russia, owned by an American businessman, Mike Matthews.
Rock and roll!
Matthews hops on a Zoom call with a cigar in his mouth, drinking coffee out of a red plastic cup. He tells me about how he became the owner of a vacuum tube factory in Russia. It started with a trade show there in 1979. He was selling guitar pedals.
I got carried away and brought a whole rock and roll band over to Russia.
He says his company got a lot of attention, but not many buyers. So he started thinking of ways he could start buying parts from Russia.
I said to myself, these vacuum tubes, those are used in guitar amps, and I'm in the guitar amp business. I bought some, I had them ship me some samples.
And he started selling them in the U.S. Then the factory in Russia nearly went under, so Matthews decided to buy it. But a few weeks ago, he found out his vacuum tubes were on a list of items that could not be shipped out of that factory.
I immediately sent an email to all of my customers, many, many hundreds of manufacturers and tube distributors, you know, to give them a heads up. that we can't ship.
And that email? Well, it had quite the ripple effect.
I think it's safe to say there were no more vacuum tubes in North America.
John Capito repairs and builds amps in Nashville. He says people were in a frenzy, wiping out the local stock of tubes and posting them on eBay for double, even triple the price. Usually he pays about $45 for a pair of new tubes. Now he's seeing used tubes going for more than $100 a pair.
And that is something that really reaches all the way across the ocean here to my daily life.
Now, a factory in Rossville, Georgia, plans to revamp production of vacuum tubes for guitar amps. Kobe Boykin works for the company Western Electric.
People want to see a return to availability, and the Made in America thing is very, very important.
But he says full-scale production isn't likely for about a year. As for Matthews's factory in Russia, he says the Russian government has given permission for it to start shipping again, perhaps as soon as this month. Until then, amp makers are hoping that once the panic subsides, the market will even back out again. You know, just like the run on toilet paper at the start of the pandemic. In Nashville, I'm Paige Flager for Marketplace.
All of the supply chain issues as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine are just one problem in a laundry list of problems in global trade right now. For example, if you are in the customs business, there are still plenty of tariffs to navigate. So we called up Gretchen Blau. She is our customs broker at Logistics Plus in Erie, Pennsylvania. And we asked her how her business has been doing.
It's been a little crazy. The port in Shanghai has been closed. Imports and exports to and from Shanghai have been at a standstill or incredibly slow. There's been capacity issues domestically, so our domestic team has had to follow up repeatedly with the trucking companies to make sure shipments have picked up and delivered. Also, we are dealing with some anti-dumping and countervailing issues with solar panels. So our solar customers are kind of in a holding pattern while they decide how this is going to play out and what their alternatives are, whether they want to bring the solar panels into the commerce of the U.S., if they want to put them in a bonded warehouse, if they want to re-export them, that type of thing. We're going to be watching solar panels, definitely. We're also going to be watching the different increases in COVID in various parts of the world. We're going to be watching Ukraine, definitely, and what's happening over there. And probably, you know, the way things have been going, there's something we haven't even thought of yet that's going to pop up and cause issues. So I can only predict so much. My job's changed over the long term. It's been, I would say, 5 or 6 years. Everything was pretty straightforward. You just basically file your entries, make sure everything's in order. We didn't have to worry about the 301 China duties. We didn't have to worry about these 201 tariffs for the solar panels and washing machines. Now everything is just a constant pivot to make sure everyone is taken care of, all of our customers are taken care of, because there hasn't been a lot of warning to some of the issues that have happened, and we've just had to make do and make sure that we have options available.
That was Gretchen Blau, customs broker in Erie, Pennsylvania. Coming up.
Opening up a bookstore is where my heart is.
Guess you gotta stay true to your shelf. I'm so sorry for that joke. That was really bad. All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones rose 344 points, 1% to close at 34,564. The Nasdaq lifted 272 points, 2% to land at 13,643. The S&P 500 found 49 points, 1.1% to end at 4,446. We heard from Matt Levin about J.P. Morgan's earnings and the bank's $500 million write-down. J.P. Morgan was down 3.2%. Other big banks, Goldman Sachs, was up 0.7%. Morgan Stanley rose 0.2%. 174.7 thousand Twitter followers is the current count for Jorts. That is an orange cat who's become a beloved supporter of organized labor. Love for Jorts started on Reddit as a thread about how orange cats are not that intelligent, which, by the way, not true. I have an orange cat myself. Shout out to Simpson. I love you. You're the best. Anyway, Jorts, or at least the human behind the account, is all about supporting large and small unions around the country, and they post regular cat-type updates about himself and his tortoise shell colleague, Gene. All right, bonds prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. Going to take a minute now to talk about education, specifically a trend we've been seeing since the pandemic started, and that is fewer kids enrolling in public schools. Take California. It's home to almost 6 million students, grades K through 12, and it announced this week that the statewide enrollment dropped by nearly 2% this academic year. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes explains what that means for schools.
In Fort Worth, Texas, Nancy Jackowicz and her husband decided to homeschool their 7-year-old daughter this year. They were worried she'd get COVID if she attended first grade in person. And Jackowicz says it was nice to have all the extra time together.
We're happy to have had a very long spring break with her over the last 2 years.
Her daughter is vaccinated now, and they want her to be able to see other kids. So they're trying to decide whether to enroll her at the local public school for next year.
We're kind of hopeful that things will kind of return to normal by the fall.
The decisions that Jackowicz and other parents around the country make drive how much money public school districts receive from their state and local governments. Many get a certain amount each year per pupil. When enrollment or, in some cases, attendance drops, so does revenue. But expenses take a while to figure out, says Janelle Kubinick with the education nonprofit WestEd.
It's not groups of 20 kids that they all talk together and say, hey, let's just not go to school at the third grade. And therefore, it reduces, you know, how many teachers you need.
Instead, Kubinick says the students leaving are distributed throughout all the grades. And right now, some schools don't know if they should even make adjustments.
Because of the last 2 years, nothing is clean. It is all messy.
Kenny Rodriguez leads a school district in Grandview, Missouri, just south of Kansas City. Enrollment there has dropped 7.5% in the last 2 years.
We don't know whether the last 2 years of the pandemic and those components, is that what's going to be our new normal, or is it going to continue to go up?
This is all happening as districts deal with inflation and higher costs. Janelle Kubinick of WestEd says that means schools have fewer resources while they're trying to figure out how to bring people in the door.
Because if, you know, your revenue is generated based on who shows up, you also have to be responsive to how do we continue to be a place that people want to come to.
Because in some ways, public schools are businesses, and post-pandemic, more of their customers are choosing other options. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
So it has been a big week of economic data. Yesterday, we got consumer prices, today, producer prices, and tomorrow, we've got retail data. Sticking with retail, over the last couple of years, we've seen more and more people shift careers and start their own business. And even though that plunge can be a bit uneasy, a bit unsettling, sometimes it can be worth the risk. And that brings me to today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is LaTanya Devon. I am from the Bronx, New York, and I am the owner and operator of Bronx Bound Books. I've worked for various companies, nonprofits, retail companies, And I thought that working for a nonprofit that served a great mission would kind of feed my soul. But I realized that the impact that I wanted to make on my personal journey, I couldn't find that that thing that inspired me to come to work every day, really. And I realized that opening up a bookstore is where my heart is. So I decided to just pursue it after not finding what I was looking for in a regular 9-to-5. I started a mobile bookstore because the Bronx is changing. Gentrification is happening and it's increasing storefront prices. So I started to research pop-up bookstores where I would just show up to places and table. And I realized that that could get old really fast. And I was going over this after I was about to quit one of my jobs. And my friend Vanessa said, "Hey, LaTanya, check this out." And she showed me a book truck. And that was the inspiration I needed to reimagine the bookstore ownership journey that I'm on now. Due to COVID, Lowe's Home Improvement, they were giving out grants for businesses. And I applied about 4 times. And on my 4th time, I was accepted and I received a grant for $20,000. And that covered the build out of the interior of the bus. And I used my savings and I bought a bus on Craigslist. We host book drives. We have a volunteer driver. His name is Jerry, and he's amazing. He goes to pick up books if someone has donations around the Bronx or in Manhattan. Right now, we have a really great partnership with an organization in Long Island, New York, called the Book Fairies, where we'll be picking up books for our events where we give out books for free. Sometimes people rent the bus itself, and the books are included with the rental. I met someone who lost The Hobbit, the book, The Hobbit, and she was able to be reunited with the book that she lost, you know, during her transition from shelters and bouncing from home to home. And she told me how she loved it and it took her to another place and she lost the book and was never able to find it again. And here it was for free. In the future, I hope to partner with organizations that serve families with an incarcerated parent. Both my parents were incarcerated in and out of jail as I grew up, and I would like to be able to connect with families who have an incarcerated parent and do, you know, events that will help them bridge the gap, partner with more schools, do more programming for the community, and continue to do what we do and make sure that our community is being served in a respectful manner.
Love that story. That was LaTanya Devon, owner of Bronx Bound Books. By the way, we cannot do this series without you, so please go to marketplace.org/myeconomy and let us know what's going on in your economy. This final note on the way out today, it is about gas prices, and how some retailers are trying to woo consumers, trying to dangle some gas-related perks. Just read today, for example, that some Krispy Kreme shops for the next few weeks will start offering a dozen glazed donuts for the price of a gallon of gas. It is aptly called donut deflation. Meanwhile, Bojangles is giving away $1 million worth of free gas gift cards if you buy their family meal. All these incentives, yeah, they're to help us, the consumers, but to also help them too. All right, we got to go. But first, here is your moment of economic context. More on gas prices. Read an article in CNBC today where they crunched some numbers and laid out just how much gas prices have risen over the last few decades. Back in 1978, it cost 65 cents a gallon, which, adjusted for inflation, is $2.99. The national average as of today is about $4.08. Also, if you're curious, gas prices are the highest right now here in California, lucky for us, and Missouri currently has the cheapest at $3.65 a gallon. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Dorado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Rima Reis, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.